senses other than these five senses. Those are like red gold, while these are like copper. The prophets communicated with the angels through these senses, and the Prophet of Islam went to Mi'raj, the ascension, with his spiritual body, and heard and saw things by his spiritual senses. These senses will be activated for all after they die.
In this world, the soul is not able to manifest its true potentials. It is governed largely by the constraints of the material world around it. And it is an uneasy, if you like, passenger in the vehicle that is the body. However, there is a purpose to this existence, and the soul requires to have this phase of its existence. But it really, if you like, flies and flourishes once it is free from that fetter of the body, and that is real life.
The spiritual body grows with us as we grow in this world. In fact, we have one aspect of this rooted in the middle world, and that is why we can communicate with that world in our dreams. So in this world, we live in two bodies, but since one is like an image of the other and completely matched on it, we realize that. Now, these two bodies belong to two dimensions of the same existence. On the moment of death, the soul discards its physical body and leaves this world with its spiritual body. So when we talk of death, we actually talk of ourselves in a new body, a body which is much more complicated and much more magnificent than our physical body.
The awareness, the power of the soul that is available to it, even in Barzakh, is exponentially different to that which was available to it in life. Even the kafir and the agnostic and the atheist, their ma'rifah and knowledge of reality is much greater than any scholar who's alive now, because the veils have been lifted and they see.
So every one of us leave this world in a spiritual body. A body which is lighter, fresher, and more agile than the body in which we are living now. A body with a special DNA partially created by us in this world. But what type of experience is death? Isn't going to be the same for all? Join me in the next episode of Discovering Islam to talk about this in more details. Until then, peace be with you.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight. The $90 billion Australian dollar submarine contract was the centerpiece of French-Australian cooperation in the Indo-Pacific. But the Australians have instead opted to form a US-UK-Australia pact, dubbed AUKUS, and build 8 nuclear-powered submarines likely to be delivered between 2030 and 2040. We're prepared for you an article written by Patrick Winter. The piece is titled France Tries to Delay EU-Australia Trade Deal Amid AUKUS Fallout. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. France is seeking to enlist European Union's support to delay a planned EU-Australia trade deal as part of a plan to punish Australia for what it regards as serial deceit and subterfuge by Canberra before it cancelled the contract for 12 attack-class French submarines. The $90 billion Australian dollar submarine contract was the centrepiece of French-Australian cooperation in the Indo-Pacific. But the Australians have instead opted to form a US-UK-Australia pact, dubbed AUKUS, and build 8 nuclear-powered submarines likely to be delivered between 2030 and 2040. The EU Commission President, Ursula von der Leyen, weighed into the diplomatic row on Monday, 20th of September, saying France had been treated unacceptably by the United States, Australia and Britain, and that many questions remain unanswered. EU foreign ministers were due to discuss the crisis on the sidelines of the United Nations General Assembly in New York. The next round of EU-Australia trade talks, the 12th, are due next month, and it remains to be seen how deeply other EU states wish to become embroiled in the fallout from the French loss of a commercial contract. The Australian Trade Minister, Dan Tehan, denied the security row would spill into the planned free trade deal with Australia's third largest trading partner. He said, "It's just very much business as usual when it comes to our negotiations on that free trade agreement." He added, "Everything points to the fact that it's in both the European Union and Australia's interests that we continue with the free trade agreement." France has recalled its ambassadors to Washington and Canberra in an unprecedented protest, and its armed forces minister, Florence Parly, currently in Mali, has postponed a planned meeting with the British Defence Secretary Ben Wallace. A planned phone call between the US President Joe Biden and the French President Emmanuel Macron, requested by Joe Biden, has not yet been put into diaries. Emmanuel Macron, facing re-election next year, was remaining silent about the commercial and diplomatic humiliation inflicted on his country, which has effectively left the French strategy for the Indo-Pacific, based on cooperation with Australia and India, in tatters. But lawyers acting for the French government and the state-backed Naval Group are already preparing a massive compensation claim that will turn on the flexibility and break clauses written into the contract first signed back in 2016. Other French options include selling nuclear-powered submarines to India or persuading the United States, Australia and Britain to let them join the AUKUS security pact and even play a role in building the submarines. Boris Johnson insisted that the pact, due to extend beyond submarine manufacture to artificial intelligence and robotics, was not intended to be exclusionary. He claimed, "The UK and France have a very, very important indestructible relationship, and of course we will be talking to all our friends about how to make the AUKUS pact work so that it is not exclusionary, not divisive, and it really does not have to be that way." Boris Johnson said the pact was just a sensible way to share certain technologies, claiming, "But that does not mean in any way that we wish to be adversarial to anyone else." The British Defence Secretary Ben Wallace, speaking in the House of Commons, also sought to soothe the French. Wallace said, "There is absolutely no intent here by the UK government to slightly upset or drive a wedge between us and France. There was no sneakiness behind the back. It was fundamentally Australia's right to choose a different capability, and it did." But the French say no mention of the planned cancellation of the contract was made by the British when Ben Wallace and the then Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab met their French counterparts in Paris to discuss their separate responsibilities in the Indo-Pacific. The value of Boris Johnson's soothing words may be reduced in French eyes by Johnson choosing to celebrate the new pact with Australia by dining at the Australian ambassador's residence in Washington. The French insist that despite direct inquiries from Australian ministers, they were never given any private warning that the contract was so close to being torn up. Australia says it was a matter of public record, including in Australian parliamentary hearings, that the government was considering a plan B due to inadequacies in the French-designed submarine, including its range. France believes that the United States, especially Kurt Campbell, the White House coordinator for the Indo-Pacific, actively encouraged Australia to drop the French contract by making the unprecedented offer to share its nuclear-powered technology with Australia. The United States feels vindicated by the support for the move among its allies in the region. The pact, or at least the humiliation of France, has not been met with universal acclaim in the Conservative Party. The Tory chair of the Defence Select Committee, Tobias Elwood, said the French had overreacted. But Elwood added, "The timing and manner of this announcement is not without diplomatic consequence and prompts further questions about the cohesion, purpose and leadership of NATO after a bruised departure from Afghanistan." Tobias Elwood said, "China's strategic behavior cannot be defeated solely by military means. We need all the tools and all the alliances working towards a common strategic goal."
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
On August 26th, a bombing outside Kabul International Airport killed scores of Afghans, as well as 13 American troops, as Afghan and foreign nationals rushed to leave the country. The incident marked the deadliest attack for U.S. troops in Afghanistan in over a decade, as Washington was wrapping up its evacuation operation. Daesh terror group claimed responsibility for the bombing. Later, on August 29th, in one of the final acts of the U.S. military in Afghanistan before ending its 20-year war in the country, Washington launched a deadly drone strike in Kabul. In what the U.S. Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Mark Milley, called a righteous strike, the Pentagon claimed it targeted a position of Daesh terrorists in retaliation for the bombing of the Kabul airport and killed at least one Daesh facilitator. However, On Friday, a U.S. Central Command investigation found that the drone strike killed 10 civilians, including 7 children, and not any Daesh terrorists.
It is further my assessment that the strike team were convinced at the time of the strike that the area was clear of civilians, and that they had taken prudent steps in regards to weaponizing the strike to minimize the potential for civilian casualties. Finally, it is my assessment that they did believe, as reported, that there was a secondary explosion. Our investigation now concludes that the strike was a tragic mistake.
General McKenzie said the U.S. intelligence had reasonable certainty that the suspected location was a Daesh position where terrorists were planning an attack on Kabul airport. The U.S. intelligence tracked an aid worker's vehicle, assuming it was linked to Daesh. They mistakenly thought the car was loaded with explosives, while it had only containers of water. In a statement, U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin admitted that the strike led to tragic death of innocent civilians and called it a horrible mistake. The catastrophic consequences of the U.S. intelligence miscalculations have exposed the human cost of war that had been fought largely from the air for years. That will fuel the criticism of the Biden administration's Afghanistan policy and chaotic withdrawal of American troops from the country after 20 years of war. For the past 2 decades, Afghanistan has been a scene of a devastating conflict. The U.S. military conducted thousands of drone strikes, killing hundreds of civilians and children.
Yes, I think that last drone strike, unfortunately, is symbolic of 20 years of killing Afghans, of destruction, and of government lies. We were told so many times in the United States that the U.S. was winning when the Taliban was taking over more and more territory. And we were told that the drone strikes are very precise and they just take out the, quote, bad guys. And so when this last drone strike happened and it killed an entire family, after the U.S. military had said it took out somebody who was an extremist, who was about to blow people up at the airport, we have to start wondering about all of the strikes that have taken place.
The U.S. military has admitted it killed 10 innocent Afghan civilians and targeted the wrong vehicle in a drone strike in Kabul on August 29th. Now, Washington is facing a double whammy of mounting pressure from inside and outside the country over the handling of the withdrawal operation, as well as the failure of U.S. intelligence. The fact that this horrible mistake was made as the U.S. troops ended their 20-year occupation will make the shambolic U.S. withdrawal even worse. The Pentagon initially defended the attack on Kabul, stressing that it killed Daesh operatives despite media reports of civilian casualties. However, with Afghanistan being under global scrutiny, the U.S. had no choice but to admit to its failure. International humanitarian organizations have called for prosecuting those suspected of criminal responsibility in the act.
Sometimes I think the intelligence is just bad, like the fact that they couldn't predict that the Taliban was ready to take over Kabul. Sometimes I think the military just doesn't care if it kills a lot of civilians and pretends that it was militants who were killed. They figure who's going to go and do the reporting, because a lot of times it's in remote areas that is very difficult for reporters to get to. And sometimes I think they use the intelligence, or they manipulate the intelligence for their own ends. For example, in the case of the U.S. invasion of Iraq, there was certainly a manipulation of the intelligence to tell the American public and the world that there were weapons of mass destruction when there weren't.
That's while the U.S. has a history of conducting similar strikes in Syria, Iraq, and Somalia, out of the spotlight without accepting any responsibility, while destroying the lives of civilians. On August 15th, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau dissolved the parliament and called a snap election. Now, Canadians are preparing to cast their ballot in the 2021 federal election on September 20th to elect members of the 44th Canadian Parliament. Polls show that the Liberal Party, led by the current Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, and the Conservatives, led by leader Erin O'Toole, are neck and neck in the race, as they are both predicted to win 32% of the national popular vote. Therefore, it is a type of election where Canadian Muslim voter groups can make a difference, as they account for 3.2% of the country's population. Muslims are mainly concerned about Islamophobia. Canada has suffered from more mass killings motivated by Islamophobia in the last 5 years than any other country in the G7. Since 2017, 11 Canadian Muslims have been killed in three deadly attacks driven by Islamophobia. The 2017 Quebec City mosque mass killing is one example, which has been the worst anti-Muslim mass murder incident in Canadian history.
Well, it's certainly out of character for most Canadians, but there is a right-wing segment of Canadian society that has gained legitimacy from the actions and words of U.S. President Donald Trump. So the Conservative Party has generally been sort of very pro-Israeli, anti-Muslim, and anti-Palestinian, and has attacked people who have expressed support for the Palestinians, claiming that they're somehow anti-Semitic.
Islamophobia is a problem deeply rooted in Canada's social and political fabric. Experts believe that the federal leaders lack what is needed to fully address the rise of hatred and systematic discrimination in this country. According to one victim, the political leadership is responsible for allowing this polarization to take place, and the years of public discourse have created this anti-Muslim hate. The Liberal Party of Canada has vowed to create a national support fund to help survivors of hate crimes. It also wants to update the federal anti-racism strategy by 2022 and approve new legislation to combat this spread of online hate. Meanwhile, the New Democratic Party and the Conservative Party have promised to tackle online hate as well. However, there is no mention of Islamophobia or racism in the major political party's entire platform. During their campaign trail, none of the Canadian major political parties held public events to address racism and Islamophobia. Also, despite all having platform planks on the issue, when questioned, none of them explained why they haven't done that.
Trudeau was always balanced and kept a Canada-independent policy. His son Justin actually has been very fair and supportive of the Muslim community, even though he has been attacked by right-wing members of the politics and also in the media. So he has actually taken some flack for taking stance in support of the Muslim community, but he has not been able to make the change for Israel, where he's still anti-Palestinian and still very much beholden to the pro-Zionist lobby in Canada.
Canadian Muslims urged their leaders to take measures to combat Islamophobia, as it has resulted in deadly attacks and rising anti-Muslim hatred. However, Canadian politicians have for years failed to do so, since they see Muslims as only potential vote-getting opportunities that belong on their platforms.
The Shanghai Cooperation Organization, SCO, has approved documents for Iran's full membership at the Eurasian Political, Economic, and Security Alliance. The decision came as the 21st summit of the organization opened in Dushanbe earlier in the day. The Islamic Republic joined the SCO in 2005 as an observer state.
SCO, with the current membership, covers close to 50% of the world population and about one-third of the world's GDP. Being a member of this organization will take a lot of pressure away in terms of Western sanctions, Western impositions, monetary manipulations via the US dollar as a remedy for payment. No more.
Leaders from eight member states and four observer states attended the annual summit in Tajikistan's capital on Friday, with the Chinese leader Xi Jinping addressing it virtually along with Russian president. She criticized sanctions imposed on world economic exchanges, urging the SCO members to stay united against attacks by other countries. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi and his counterpart from Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan, Belarus, Pakistan, Turkmenistan, and Uzbekistan attended in person. Addressing the summit, President Raisi said the world today has entered a new era when hegemony and unilateralism are declining.
The world is entering a new era with a new order. Domination and unilateralism are on the decline. International order is moving toward multipolarization and redistribution of power in favor of independent states.
The Iranian president also underlined that sanctions are preventing regional cooperation and urged the SCO to define mechanisms to fight these challenges. In his address at the SCO summit, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi described sanctions as economic terrorism and the hegemonic power's most important tool to impose their own will on the others. He warned that unilateral sanctions are not limited to one country, but as it has become clear in recent years, they include more independent countries, particularly the SCO member states. Two key members of the alliance, Russia and China, have also come under sanctions from the West. Ties between Washington and Beijing deteriorated after former U.S. President Donald Trump took office in 2017, waging an economic war against China. While many expected the current administration of Joe Biden to mark a departure from Trump's hawkish policies, it adopted a tougher stance against China and Russia, imposing several rounds of sanctions on them on various pretexts.
Western trade currency restrictions do not exist in the SCO member countries. This will drastically reduce the potential for Western sanctions and will increase, on the other hand, Iran's potential to deal with the East, for example, or especially China and Russia, entering partnership agreements with these and other SCO countries, benefiting from comparative advantages.
At the end of the summit, SCO member states signed the Dushanbe Declaration, in which they stress opposition to interference under the excuse of counterterrorism or human rights, or solving key international and regional issues through small cliques, ideology, or confrontation mentality. They also agreed on strengthening cooperation in cracking down on terrorism, extremism, and separatism, and reached a consensus in supporting building an inclusive government in Afghanistan.
The Israel regime has reportedly started a cyber sabotage campaign in the UAE to interfere with the regional air and maritime navigation in West Asia.
Cyber warfare is becoming more and more important and more dangerous as well. So Israel wants to take advantage of any opportunities there.
The campaign seeks to disrupt the Persian Gulf and the Sea of Oman region's air and maritime navigation systems, thus destabilizing the regional security situation. On the other hand, the bid seeks to transit the focal point of crisis away from the occupied territories towards the region and therefore reduce the political and security pressure faced by the regime's ruling body. The UAE has signed dozens of memorandums of understanding with Israel since it became the first Arab state to normalize ties with Israel this century.
Israel sees itself with the Sunni monarchies and the conservatives as their potential allies in this. So it wants to be able to conduct the kind of cyber sabotage and infiltration that is becoming so important, so much more important. So it's not surprising that they would do this when they have the opportunity, and the UAE is providing that opportunity for them.
Israel has said that it expects $1 billion in trade with the UAE by the end of 2021 and $3 billion in 3 years. The UAE aims to raise the value of economic activity with Israel to more than $1 trillion in the next 10 years. According to regional observers, at the heart of the UAE's desire to normalize ties with the regime in Tel Aviv was his penchant for U.S.-made F-35 fighter jets, which the peace deals with Israel, known as the Abraham Accords, made possible. To the Persian Gulf state, established full diplomatic relations with the Tel Aviv regime in a deal brokered by the former U.S. President Donald Trump. Shortly after the deal was reached, the Trump administration authorized the sale of 50 advanced F-35 fighter jets to the UAE. The UAE and Israel are reportedly deepening their ties and espionage activities in the region. The UAE has helped Israel set up a center for military and maritime reconnaissance on the strategic Yemeni island of Socotra. The Red Crescent Society of the United Arab Emirates has signed a contract with the Tel Aviv regime in order to create an intelligence center for the Israeli Air Force at Socotra Airport. Socotra is home to some 60,000 people. It overlooks the Bab el-Mandab Strait, a main shipping route that connects the Red Sea to the Gulf of Aden and the Arabian Sea. It also has a unique ecosystem, which is already being exploited by the Emiratis. The mission reportedly aimed at collecting information from across the Gulf of Aden, including Bab el-Mandab and south of Yemen, which is under the control of forces backed by the UAE. Socotra has been a source of tensions between the UAE and Saudi Arabia. They have been jockeying for position for control of the island's unique resources in the absence of a powerful government in Yemen amid a ferocious war on the country. Back in June 2020, UAE-backed separatists of the so-called Southern Transitional Council, or the STC, took control of Socotra.
As you know, Israel has always welcomed the opportunity to have alliances within what it has considered to be the enemy camp, namely the Arabs. And in the opportunity with an alliance is to profit in various ways, to build one's power through espionage.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Biden administration has fully embraced a Trump-era policy that exposes refugees to grave dangers while exacerbating the spread of COVID-19, says Colin Kivalan Ryder in an article published under the heading, "Why is Biden administration turning its back on asylum seekers?" Stay tuned for more. After taking some laudable first steps to restore access to asylum, the Biden administration has fully embraced a Trump-era policy that exposes refugees to grave dangers while exacerbating the spread of COVID-19. Known as Title 42, the policy exploits an obscure public health law to close American borders to people seeking asylum. The Trump administration introduced Title 42 in 2020, purportedly to curb the spread of COVID-19. Under Title 42, people who ask for asylum at the border are denied the opportunity to seek safety. They are instead summarily expelled by U.S. officials to Mexico or to the very countries they have fled.
We have seen the tragic results. Human rights investigators have documented more than 6,300 kidnappings, rapes, and other violent assaults against people expelled to Mexico during the first 7 months of the Biden administration. Others have been placed on death flights to countries in violent turmoil, such as Haiti. Families with infants, pregnant women, survivors of severe torture, none have been spared. When questioned about their decision to continue and even escalate expulsions of asylum seekers, administration officials echo their predecessors, claiming the policy is a pandemic necessity. But public health and epidemiological experts have seen through this justification since day one. In fact, the Trump White House imposed Title 42 over objections from top doctors within the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC. It's to keep Hispanics out of the country, and it's wrong, lamented Dr. Martin Cetron, the agency's director of global migration and quarantine. In fact, Stephen Miller, Trump's chief immigration advisor, floated the idea of invoking public health authority to close the border long before COVID-19 entered the picture. And let's be clear, there is no coherent public health rationale for singling out people seeking safety. While Title 42 has completely shut the door on asylum seekers, the U.S. government has allowed tens of millions of other travelers, including tourists, to cross the U.S.-Mexico border freely during the pandemic with no testing or quarantine requirements. Public health experts have implored the administration to see reason and stop the expulsions. They have even provided a detailed roadmap for the administration to safely process people arriving at the border while ensuring the health of U.S. officials, asylum seekers, and the communities that receive them. We have robust mitigation measures at our disposal, including the highly effective and widely available vaccines and testing, one official said. The obstacles to ending Title 42 are about politics, not public health. With the emergence of the Delta variant and surging COVID-19 cases, particularly in states with low vaccination rates, anti-immigrant politicians and pundits have been quick to point the finger at people seeking asylum and the community groups that welcome them. Politicians, notorious for rejecting evidence-based COVID-19 measures for their own constituents, have been among the worst culprits, as though eager to deflect blame for their actions. The epidemiological data belie their fear-mongering. There is no evidence that asylum seekers are driving current COVID-19 surges or the spread of the Delta variant. Yet the Biden administration has now extended Title 42 indefinitely, citing emerging variants as justification. With no end to the policy in sight, public health experts are again raising the alarm. Former CDC officials are speaking out, as are courageous health professionals who continue to put their lives on the line to help those U.S. government has expelled to some of the most dangerous regions in Mexico. In a rare public rebuke, the U.N. Refugee Agency has appealed to the administration to end Title 42. Policies and practices President Biden announced on the campaign trail are now becoming his legacy. But it's not too late to change the course. The Biden administration can choose to stop playing politics with people's lives and end Title 42, along with all other policies that endanger those seeking asylum. The U.S. has public health know-how to safely welcome people escaping persecution with dignity.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
According to the results of parliamentary elections in Russia, United Russia ruling party received a constitutional majority in the State Duma. The Communist Party took the second place, with the Liberal Democratic Party the third one. Then goes Fair Russia and New People. Thus, these five parties overcome the 5% barrier to enter the State Duma. United Russia is promoting President Vladimir Putin's agenda, which is also enshrined in last year's social amendments to the Constitution.
I want to thank all our voters who voted for United Russia and our candidates. This is a great trust and no less great responsibility for us. I also want to thank those who voted for other political parties. We respect your position and the choice you made.
The State Duma is elected in Russia for a five-year term under a mixed system, 225 deputies according to party lists, another 225 in single-mandate constituencies in one round. The results haven't been without controversy, however. There have been widespread accusations of fraud and misconduct. Throughout the 3 days of voting, many videos shared online appeared to show voters and officials stuffing ballot boxes with multiple voting slips. In Moscow, some opposition figures accused officials of delaying the release of online voting results to give them an opportunity to manipulate. In response, Kremlin hailed the parliamentary elections as open, competitive, and honest.
Voter turnout was notably high, especially on the last day of voting. This election will also be remembered by a large number of candidates.
The team of jailed opposition figure Alexei Navalny accused the authorities of foul play, declaring all the victories against his candidates they supported as part of a controversial smart voting scheme as falsification. Earlier before the elections, Russia's telecom watchdog demanded the Navalny app be removed from App Store and Google Play based on a ruling by the Russian Prosecutor General's office.
For the first time this year's federal elections in Russia took place over 3 days. This year, election organizers have also introduced electronic voting devices. So far, residents of only seven regions in Russia have been able to vote using these devices. According to the Constitution, the new State Duma should meet on the 30th day following the election day.
But the president has the right to convene the first meeting of the lower house of parliament even earlier than this date. The Russian president has already exercised this right after previous elections. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
The issue centers around a contract signed 5 years ago worth up to 50 billion euro for France to build 12 submarines for Australia. Out of the blue, Paris found out a few days ago that the deal is off. France is furious, and so too is the EU. Talks on a new trade deal between the 27-nation bloc and Australia took place in June and were due to resume in October. We're told that's now in doubt.
We are analysing the impact of the AUKUS announcement and what this impact could be on this schedule.
AUKUS is a new security deal signed between the US, Britain and Australia. It means France's submarines are no longer acquired. The country's foreign minister, Jean-Yves Le Drian, says it's a stab in the back from allies.
There will be consequences. Consequences, of course, for the French relationship with the US, with Australia, with the UK. But that also implies there will be consequences for the relationship between the EU and these countries.
Senior EU ministers will discuss their response to the diplomatic crisis in the early hours of Tuesday morning, Brussels time.
There will be a meeting of EU 27 foreign ministers chaired by HMVP Borrell in New York on the margins of the UN General Assembly.
Paris has already withdrawn its ambassadors from Washington and Canberra. The AUKUS nuclear submarines will use the latest undersea technologies in the South China Sea. Beijing says the move smacks of Cold War mentality. North Korea warns it could trigger a nuclear arms race. Political analysts are suggesting Australia and Britain need to be very circumspect when dealing with the US. They point to all the international agreements Trump pulled the plug on. Also, Biden indicated he would rejoin the Iran nuclear deal. That still hasn't happened. And look at the impact of U.S. unilateral decisions with respect to Afghanistan. Many are asking, can Washington really be trusted? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
A lengthy parliamentary session was held in Beirut to discuss the cabinet manifesto and give the Miqati cabinet a vote of confidence. Session began with an address by the prime minister, who briefed the members of parliament on the most significant issues which will be dealt with.
The socio-economic challenges should be among our top priorities. The government has no way but to put its focus on reforms to pave the way for uplifting the economy, developing the productive sectors, and attracting foreign investment. In addition to these files, we need to have an independent judicial body.
Prime Minister stressed that his cabinet will directly begin negotiations with the International Monetary Fund, and its main objective will include the general reforms and a restructuring of the banking sector. In light of Lebanon's current dire economic descent, the majority of Lebanese lawmakers decided to give a confidence vote to a cabinet which considers itself in a state of relief efforts.
We want to give Lebanon a chance to recover and to stop the collapse that is happening, the free fall that is happening, actually. And this is why we're giving it a chance, actually, based on also a program that we discussed with the Prime Minister and that included a lot of the requirements and the requests we have put in it.
Miqati's 24-member cabinet is also expected to offer solutions to shortages of medicine and fuel and to launch a social welfare card as a compensation for the local currency's lost value.
The government is expected to address all of these problems together, but they have to prioritize the problems. The Lebanese now, the mere Lebanese, the lay Lebanese, and the majority of the Lebanese are not capable of meeting their basic needs in order to survive. So we pin the hopes on the government to be able to prioritize the needs of the people and to address the most important. When we talk about the most important, we talk about the financial crisis, we talk about correcting the level of the wages for the Lebanese, and even to give a compensation so they can meet their basic needs.
The Miqati cabinet has vowed to prepare for parliamentary elections and hold them on time in May of 2022. The Miqati cabinet has stressed in its manifesto that now is the time for action and not words. The lawmakers, for their part, have considered that this government and all future cabinets must work on rebuilding the economy instead of relying on grants and loans. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Far away from their homes, the battle for survival continues for thousands of Rohingya refugees living across India. After fleeing war-ravaged Myanmar and what the UN described as ethnic cleansing, they are now trying to rebuild their shattered lives in different parts of the world. But in India, they are sometimes called illegal immigrants and threat to national security, which activists describe as a deliberate attempt to target a particular community. Apparently, they are also accused of illegal activities. But these claims were not reflected in the recently released National Crime Records Bureau analysis.
There is no evidence whatsoever about Rohingyas being involved in anything even close to terrorist activity. This is the paranoia of the Indian deep state, which increasingly wants to do all this fear-mongering to increase its budget.
Based on analysis of the Government Crime Records Agency for 2020, Myanmar nationals accounted for just 2% of the total crimes allegedly committed by foreigners. Analysts say there is no case of terror, rape, or keeping arms against any Rohingya refugee, which belies the government claim of calling them a security threat.
We just want to stay alive. We are no threat to anyone since we are humans and have family too. We are really in a miserable state as a detention and expulsion campaign is going on.
Based on official estimates, some 40,000 Rohingya refugees are living in parts of India. Many refugees I spoke with had almost similar views. They say they felt safe in India since they arrived, but over the last few years, hate campaigns against the community are haunting them. As refugee crises continue to be the biggest challenge facing the world, rights activists say Rohingya community in particular has largely been ignored despite the levels of atrocities it has endured, both at home and as refugees. They say India needs to rethink and redraw its refugee policy regardless of the geostrategic interest and stand by its ethos, considering the world as a family. Minority Rohingya Muslims have for decades fled to neighboring Bangladesh and other countries, including India, escaping genocide in their country. Regardless of the refugee crisis across the world, the community continues to be neglected and unseen victims of violence. Munawar Zaman in the outskirts of New Delhi.
Protesters set up a cage outside Denmark's embassy in Iran, a cage with a cake inside to celebrate the fifth birthday of Dariush. This is the second year in a row that Dariush's mother, Mahsa, celebrates her son's birthday without him, as Dariush has been taken away from his family by the Copenhagen municipality for parental incompetence reasons, something which the distraught mom dismisses as unfair. She says she misses her son.
My son suffers from autism, but the Danish authorities blame me for all of my son's disorders, like inability to sleep or eat. I was even referred to a pediatrician who approved that my son is an autistic. But the authorities in Denmark refused to accept the reality and accused me of misbehavior toward my child. I urge the Iranian government and the foreign ministry to take measures so I can see my son again.
Mahsa has lived in Denmark for 6 years, but does not have the Danish permanent residency. She says she and her husband have both agreed to return to Iran, but Copenhagen refuses to grant them their son's custody. Rights activists here demand that the Danish government help Mahsa reunite with her son.
In every country, the law says that if a family is unfit to keep in the custody of their children, the government must remove the children from that family. But regarding Mahsa's case, the Danish government needs to hand the affected child to the relative Iranian entities to take care of the issue, because Mahsa does not have a permanent Danish residency and the case should be delegated to her country of origin.
While it was not possible for journalists and Mahsa to reach the Danish embassy to investigate the matter, Mahsa says she continues to publicize her cause and try any available legal channel to take her son back.
Apparently, it takes a lengthy and complicated legal procedure for Mahsa to get to her son. But what's clear is that 5-year-old Dariush is now living far from his mom, and nothing can replace the peaceful bosom of a mother for a child. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Thirteen days after breaking out from Gilboa Jail, Israel's maximum security prison, Ayham Kalamji and Munadal Enfi'at were rearrested by Israeli forces during a military incursion into northern city of Jenin in the occupied West Bank. Kalamji and Enfi'at, both members of the Islamic Jihad movement, were the last of six Palestinian prisoners who escaped Gilboa prison on September 6. Like their fellow inmates, they were immediately taken to an unknown place for interrogation, and the Israeli authorities have extended their detention to continue the interrogation process. Palestinian Authorities Commission of Detainees Affairs held Israel responsible for their lives and said it's illegal to retry prisoners who are already serving sentences and life sentences.
Israelis are trying to cover up the scandal of the prison break. The prisoners who succeeded to flee were serving life sentences. Now, Israel's decision to extend their detention under interrogation serves only to soothe the public outrage on Israeli streets. We warn Israeli authorities against harming the prisoners, especially if they continue placing them in solitary confinement for lengthy periods after their interrogation.
The inmates were arrested after a large number of Israeli troops raided different parts of Jenin. Clashes broke out between Palestinians and Israeli soldiers in a number of locations, with stones and explosives thrown towards Israeli forces. A number of Palestinians were moderately wounded during the clashes, according to medics. Moreover, two Palestinians were arrested during the operation. The Israeli military claims they had helped Kalamji and Enfi'at hide in Jenin.
Israel boasted of a security image, but it was tarnished by the Palestinian inmates' prison break. Now, even the rearrest of the last two inmates in Jenin cannot boost the image. The prison break was a great blow for Israel.
Last weekend, Zakaria Zubaydi, Mahmoud Arda, Mohammad Qadiri, and Mohammad Arda were captured by Israeli forces in and near Nazareth, northern the occupied lands. Their lawyers said the men have been subjected to physical and mental abuse and torture by Israeli interrogators, and each of them is placed in 2-by-1-square-meter room, lacking basic necessities for life.
Palestinians say Israel's security failure can never be rectified by the rearrest of the 6 prisoners or through the Israeli military operations across the occupied territories. They add the fact at the end of the day proves that the jailbreak has embarrassed Israel's security establishment. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
The rearrest of the last 2 remaining of Palestinian inmates who had escaped from an Israeli jail has sparked public outrage among the Palestinians. Palestinians have come together in the Gaza Strip to voice their anger at Israel's growing pressure on the Palestinian inmates.
We in the Gaza Strip stress that fight against the Israeli occupation will go on and the rearrest of the inmates won't deter us from expressing our solidarity with them. The prison break of the Palestinian inmates has inflicted a heavy blow on Israel's image. The resistance front has vowed to set them free in the coming exchange deal. We will never forget this achievement.
Reports say the 2 men were caught alive in Jenin, their hometown in the West Bank, after they were surrounded by Israeli army.
We have come here to condemn the inhumane Israeli treatment of our prisoners. Our message to our inmates is that we will keep supporting them until they are freed. The international community has ignored the issue of Palestinian prisoners for years.
2 weeks ago, 6 Palestinian inmates caved through a dug hole in the floor of their shared cell, exposing deep security flaws of the Israeli system. Palestinians held several rallies calling for ending the Israeli violation of prisoners' rights.
Palestinians will keep holding events like this to voice their support to our detainees in Israeli jails. Israeli regime should know that our prisoners are not alone and we view them as symbol of resistance. The international community should break its silence and expose the true nature of Israeli regime.
Thousands of Palestinians are held in Israeli jails, with hundreds of them under the practice of administrative detention.
Palestinians here stress the rearresting of 2 inmates who broke out of the Jilbo prison does not hide the fragility of the Israeli security system. Palestinians see this cave as a remarkable incident in the history of the Palestinian cause, demanding the international community to stop Israel's torture against detainees. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
The serial killings of Iranian scientists must stop. This comment was made by families of the 5 slain nuclear scientists who were allegedly assassinated by Israeli agents. Now, the households of the victims have filed a lawsuit against the U.S. for its support for Tel Aviv and what people here call terrorist activities against Iran.
I believe the reason that they did this in front of my eyes and my mother's eyes was to terrorize people. That's what terrorists do.
We have already gotten too late into this legal proceeding. They killed my husband 12 years ago, and I still feel the pain. It's not easy to forget such a great loss. The point is, America and Israel do not feel sorry for this, and that's why we ask Iranian and international judicial systems to bring the perpetrators to justice.
Iran